So we've made a big journey with the Ten Commandments, and we're nearly at the end. We're at the penultimate commandment, or the second commandment, given that we're working our way back from 10 to 1. Can you remember what we've been looking at? Coveting, lying, stealing, adultery, and murder. And trying not to do those things. Topics that relate to how we relate to our neighbours and those close to us. And then we looked at how we should honour our parents. And then finally, and in this last part of the series, we've been thinking about how we relate to God himself. Firstly, kind of indirectly, how we keep the Sabbath and follow his pattern for rest. How we honour him in how we speak about him. And now, in the last two commandments, we think specifically on who God is. We'll get to the finale next week, but this week we look not so much as to who he is, but to who he is not. Realistically, we all know that Christianity has been on the decline in recent decades. But religious activity hasn't been declining. Partly, there have been other religious groups and formal religions growing in the UK, like Islam and Buddhism, and less formal religions like the New Age spirituality. Alongside this growth, there has been a rejection of what people might describe as old-style religious authority. And in many ways, that's been a good thing. But people now say, I'll believe what I want. Don't tell me what I should believe. And moreover, I don't really want my religion to make any tough demands on me. In fact, it's more of a lifestyle choice. And of course, if you add into the mix the ascendancy of the value of tolerance above all things, we end up with, thou shalt not say, thou shalt not. So the Ten Commandments, in some ways, run a little bit countercultural to all of that. And I wonder if you've been thinking about them for yourself, how they've been applied into your life. Because the world in which we live, and perhaps this seeps into our own thinking as well, would prefer to make God in our own image. A God as we would like him to be. Neatly packaged. Controlled. G.K. Chesterton, the English writer, said, when people stop believing in God, big G, they don't believe in nothing, they believe in anything. We now worship anything that suits us. And do you know what the Bible calls this? It calls it idolatry. Now, we didn't have the reading from the Ten Commandments today. We had an interesting reading that comes only 12 chapters after the Ten Commandments. So let me fill in a little bit of the picture. Just before we have that account of the making of the golden calf, 12 chapters earlier, we have these words from God. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Now, the account of the golden calf, which is probably fairly familiar to us, is in many ways laughable if it wasn't so serious. Remember, it's only 12 chapters after the people have had Moses deliver the Ten Commandments to them. They've seen him go up the mountain, they've seen the awesome power of God on the top of the mountain, and now they're collecting all of their jewelry together to make something to worship. It sounds crazy, doesn't it? That so quickly they turn to that. But it sets up a problem, because if I talk about idolatry, probably our mind turns to golden calves, to statues, to things we've seen on our Far Eastern holidays or on the telly. And for most of us, let's face it, the idea of bowing down to a golden calf is completely ridiculous. And so we sit back comfortably, fold our arms and say, well, that commandment's passed. No problems. But here's the rub. Idols don't have to be figures made of stone or precious wood or metal. They don't have to be things that you can feel or touch at all. In fact, the most powerful idols exist in our minds. Our imaginations are places where idols are made and continuously fed and crafted and shaped. So what is idolatry? A definition is a bit hard, so let me try these statements with you. Would you agree with any of these? God gives me purpose, meaning, and fulfillment. God governs the way I act. God is the focal point about which my existence hangs. God is often in my thoughts. Thinking about God comforts me when I'm anxious. I read about God. I talk about him. I desire more of God. I get most of us here could sign up to most of those. But then, is there any way in anything else takes the place of God's? Are there any things that we might put in the place of God in the above statements? Let me just read them again. And just think for yourself for a minute if there's anything or anyone else who would be, if you're honest with yourself, really better placed in that statement. God gives me purpose, meaning, and fulfillment to my life. God governs the way I act. God is the focal point around which my existence hangs. God is often in my thoughts. Thinking about God comforts me when I'm anxious. I read about God. I talk about him. I desire more of him. I just wonder if we're being honest with ourselves, whether anything else appeared in that list. Money, home, family, sport, music, career, relationships. Why are we so prone to idolatry? Well, the first reason is that idols are not basically evil. The list I've just read out, all of those things are good, aren't they? They're all good things. But the most dangerous idols are good things that we have twisted. None of those things are bad. But the very best things make the most tempting idols. Let me go off piste for a little bit, maybe to an area that's perhaps a little bit more comfortable to us and not quite as close to home. I wonder if any of us would describe ourselves as nationalists. You see, God made different peoples and he loves diversity. It's good to celebrate our individual cultures, to love our nation and to be proud of it. But those attitudes, if they're taken to the nth degree, can become an idol. They can become something darker. If race or nationalism becomes the central feature in our lives, then it has become an idol. And where does that take human beings? 1930s Germany, Rwanda, Northern Ireland, and much of the horrible stuff on social media at the moment about Chinese people and the coronavirus. Nationalism can become an idol. Now, idols are attractive because they don't make many demands on us. Think about the golden calf again. All the jewelry is collected together and melted into a golden calf. Did the people really think they were making a god? Capital G? I don't think so. Of course not. They'd just seen and heard the power of God on top of the mountain. They weren't making God capital G, but little g gods. A controllable imitation of the real thing that was going to give them a feel-good factor. Moses comes down, and what does he hear them? They're singing. And the scary thing is that the Bible tells us that the best and the wisest people can fall prey to idolatry. Last year, together, we looked at Proverbs, and we all agreed how important Proverbs was and how timeless they were for our instruction today. And many of us will live our lives by some important Proverbs from the Bible. Who wrote Proverbs? Solomon, the wisest man of his age. But by his old age, the Bible tells us that Solomon had turned to the worship of foreign gods. So it happens to the wisest of people. Tim Keller, a modern pastor in America, has said this: sin is not about doing bad things, but about wanting good things too badly. So does it really matter? A couple of weeks ago, I went to watch a gathering. There were about 14,000 people at this gathering. There was lots of singing and chanting, lots of food and drink. It was a party celebration. Everybody walked away reasonably happy because it happened to be a draw between the two groups of people they were watching battle it out in front of them with a round object. Lots of singing. Was that worship? Does it matter that people have football or shopping or films at the heart of their lives? Surely God doesn't really feel threatened by that. And surely he doesn't feel threatened by other religions and beliefs, because he's God after all. Isn't he big enough to cope? Well, of course he's big enough to cope. But at the heart of idolatry is our heart. And I don't think it's too far to say that actually we love some of these things. For those of you who are married, you will know that there's only room for love between two people in a marriage for it to thrive and indeed survive. Last week we had a couple of the wedding couples here, and this weekend coming we've got the others who are coming. And last weekend we discussed the danger of allowing anything or anyone else into that precious space of covenant love. Now God made each one of us to experience his love. He made us in his image, and he wants us to know his love in all its fullness. Whether or not we're married, he wants us to know his love. But in fact, do you know that marriage itself points to something much bigger? Marriage is simply a foretaste of something in heaven. In the Bible, in Revelation chapter 21, it talks about God bringing the New Jerusalem prepared as a bride for her husband. The New Jerusalem is Christians in heaven. And who are they prepared for? They're prepared to be married to Jesus. So when we get to heaven, we're going to be married to Jesus. That's the picture of the Bible that it's pointing to. And marriage is a foretaste of that. It's one of the most precious and special things. But it's pointing to something. It's pointing to an intimate relationship. And God wants us to have a taste of that now. Whether or not we're married, he wants us to have a taste of that love. He's searching for us. He made us, and he wants us to know how much he loves us. And he demonstrated that love for us by sending Jesus to die for us. And he wants us to love him wholeheartedly in return. And so anything that gets in the way of that is serious. If you think about it, idolatry cheats and destroys the idolater. It is a lie. We take things that are not God and we treat them as if they are God. Sex murmurs to us that if we serve it, it will give us ultimate pleasure. And it doesn't. Some people worship marriage, not realizing that marriage is actually just pointing towards a heavenly marriage. And so they lay burdens on one another in their marriage that no partner can completely fulfill. Some people worship possessions, the next new car, the next makeover of our home, the next holiday. And these idols enslave their followers. We jokingly say, don't we, shop till you drop. Well, some people literally do drop because they shop so much, not so much that they get tired, but they get into debt and it destroys them and their families. Here's a fascinating insight from a psalm written hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Hear how pertinent these words are for today. Our God is in heaven and he does whatever pleases him, but their idols, talking about the Israelites, are silver and gold, made by human hands. They have mouths, but they cannot speak, eyes, but they cannot see. They have ears, but they cannot hear, noses, but they cannot smell. They have hands, but they cannot feel. They cannot walk, nor can they utter a sound with their throats. Those who make them will become like them, and so will all who trust in them. Psalm 115. You see, idolatry makes us eventually less than the human beings that God has made us to be. And idolatry also cheats us out of the living God and our connection with his love. 1600 years ago, St. Augustine, a wise theologian, said, "You have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you." So why are we so stupid? Why do we look for rest in other things? Why do we not look for that perfect rest in the one who made us? God doesn't stand still either. He's a God of the ancient and the new. And sometimes people make an idol of God of the past, and they're never able to move on from their picture of God of the past. And we need to pay attention to this in our churches, because one of the dangers of the Christian faith is that we acquire a certain view of God and we cling on to it. Now, don't get me wrong, we need to cling on to the truths of God from the past, but sometimes we let the past set our agenda for the future. We worship the form of things over the substance. There's a fascinating encounter that Anne read for us from the end of the encounter between Jesus and the Samaritan woman at the well. And the Samaritan woman came from a group of people who believed the only place to worship God was up on a mountain. Jesus came from the Jewish people who said the only place to worship God was in a temple. So they had a problem. Which was the right place? Jesus said to them, actually, there's a time coming when you won't even worship God in a mountain or in a temple. You will worship in spirit and in truth. It's been fascinating, actually, the journey we've been on over at Ardley. If you've been up to worship at the Methodist Church, we've been having quite an interesting existential experience through that. I've had some fascinating conversations. Some people have said, can we stay in the Methodist Church, please? I said, that's lovely. It's a lovely building. We are spending quite a lot of money on the heating system from St. Mary's, so maybe we'll go back there and enjoy the heating. But maybe we'll take some of the principles, some of the things we've experienced together at the Methodist Church about actually being closer physically together, coronavirus notwithstanding, and actually take those back into St. Mary's with us. Sometimes in the life of the church, Christian people can get so wedded to a building that they don't feel they can worship God anywhere else. Dare I say it? If that's the case, then that building is an idol. So let's be open to what God might want to say to us in all of this. St. Paul, when he spoke to the Greek people in Athens on what we now know as Mars Hill, he said he'd walked around and seen temples and statues to many, many gods. He said, I even found this inscription on an altar to an unknown god. He stood up in front of that group, the council of that city, and he said, I want to tell you something. The God that you don't know is the God who made the world and everything in it, the Lord of heaven and earth. He doesn't live in temples built by human hands. He gives everyone life and breath and everything else. So how do we counter idolatry? Well, in one sense, it's very simple. We need to focus more on God ourselves. We need to soak in the truth about who God is. We need to worship God. Praise is the biggest way to counter idolatry. It focuses our attention on the God who made us and who loves us. And it puts everything else into its right perspective. So I wonder about those questions as we conclude. I'll just go back to them at the beginning and I'll leave them with you. And I'll leave you to think about them as we sing a hymn of praise to God. Does God give you purpose, meaning, and fulfillment? Does he govern the way you act? Is he the focal point about which your existence hangs? Is he often in your thoughts? Does he comfort you when you're anxious? Do you read about him and talk about him? Do you desire more of him? Because if you do, you will find that he brings life, and life in all its fullness. Amen. So we're going to sing to and about this God in an additional hymn today. We're going to sing number 676, which is a beautiful, depthful description of God in all his majesty, but in his intimacy and closeness as well. Immortal and invisible, but also great Father. Immortal, invisible God, only wise. Let's stand and sing together.